Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. It's underneath of Don here. Jane Miller is our guest. We're doing segment two of podcast one with her, and we're all looking at Rob Roblin.
Absolutely.
Rob's like
the
cameraman.
In the house.
We're in El Guapo. We're in Catonsville. It's all presented by the Maryland Lottery. Rob Roblin.
We've got 100 years.
Oh, more
TV
than that.
Brilliance in this room today.
Well, the Reach is going to get Betty Boop tickets, courtesy of the Maryland Lottery. I appreciate the Hearst Corporation and Stan and everyone else for sending. Jay, we talk so much about free speech and what you do here locally and on a day-by-day basis. Our city government, our state government, COVID, misinformation, vaccines, all of this. Locally, there's still so much going on that you guys are 24/7, literally, into this. Mm-hmm. The murder thing and that number that sits with us. The last time you were on, it was before COVID, I believe, or maybe the early part of COVID. You were teetering a little bit on the city, and I had said something to you. Were you going to run for mayor? Because people.
Oh, yeah.
That thing all started, right?
Right.
But where we are in the city now, with Brandon coming out of this, I mean, we just found out that there's one tenant left in Harbor Place, Hooters. I sold my place courtesy of Moeller and Gary Realty not to evacuate the city. We were almost going to live in Canton, quite frankly. But we took a beating. We took a beating on selling our place. I mean, a bloodletting, really, for a lifetime of investment in the city. And I love the city, Baltimore Positive. How are you? How are you doing on the city right now?
Well, look, I mean, I've been in city, homeowner for a long time. I've been covering the city for a long time. Look, there's no question it is frustrating and disappointing to me that the city as a whole is not in a better place. Parts of the city are in a way better place. Parts of the east side of Baltimore, the southeast side of Baltimore, the Barclay area now, and there's a lot of redevelopment going on. But at the end of the day, you can't have a healthy, stable city if you don't have a healthy, stable economy in the city. And if you look at the way the region has developed, most of the development, and Don would know this, is really along the 95 corridor, up and down. I mean, that's really where the employment is. And I'm talking about all levels of jobs, because you've got these huge warehouse developments up and down 95. You get to the airport and you've got, Northrop Grumman, you got big tech companies and everything else around the airport. You got the NSA and you got a lot of companies that are, located
well, Port
there.
Port Covington's the greatest example of that.
Well, that's right.
Trade Point Atlantic.
Right. Yeah. Develops along 95. The problem is, it's almost like a disconnect. You never hear the Baltimore City elected officials talk about the port much. And the port is an enormous economic engine. And, if you just drive by it, it's like, wow, And so what does the port need? The port needs people who have training and education in logistics, shipping, all of that kind of thing, And I just don't feel like there is a connection between policymaking and decisions that, for policymaking and, kind of like we said before, what are the resources in front of you?
Yeah, go to school here to learn this, work there.
So you have the
so
labor
you can live
pool
here, right?
That's available for... I mean, Baltimore really needs a home run. You mentioned the harbor. Okay, the harbor is a wonderful asset to the city of Baltimore. It's beautiful. But we have relied on this retail shopping idea there since 1980. And that model is dead everywhere, that tried it.
It's dead in White Marsh. It's dead in Owings Mills,
But
the
not,
mall.
Not
the necess- mall.
No, actually that kind of urban mall type thing. It just, Boston had Faneuil Hall, et cetera, et cetera. It needs a reimagination of what it should be. What does it offer? It offers a natural setting on the water. Most cities would die to have that kind of setting. So now what do you want to do with it? What is the best thing there? The problem is it is tied up in this receivership proceeding, and Don can talk to you about the challenge of that. I think that I did a story in the summer of 2020 about, what should happen to the Inner Harbor, and Lori Schwartz, who's the head of the Waterfront Partnership, she said they have now reached the conclusion that those buildings should be demolished. And what should be in their place is much more of a flexible, food truck, food court, open space for live events. Some of the nicest events that they've held on the Inner Harbor in the last 10 years are like the Book Festival, arts festivals. Think about moving the downtown farmers market there on a Sunday.
Light City's beautiful.
I think you're really on to something. It's something that we're very interested in. We've had folks, and actually we're going to have them back on soon again, some of the folks from May and Reichel who were very much involved, obviously, in the Rashfield project.
Yes, correct.
And,
nice.
And I think the Rashfield project, I hear nothing but
it's amazing.
Glowing.
Right. It's amazing.
Glowing comments about the new Rashfield project. What I hear embedded in your comment is something that we've asked about. We've talked, and we consider the mayor a friend. Is we'd like to see a sense of urgency around Harbor
Not
Place.
Not the only one.
Bring together a group of the best and brightest minds. Put them on a timetable. Have public input, and as you said, let's reimagine Harbor Place. But let's not accept just another article about another retailer leaving. And I mean, I remember very clearly because I'm so old. I'm like Roblin. We're old.
Why does he look so good?
He's just healthier than I am. But I remember when it opened and my children were little. And it's not an exaggeration to say that at least twice a month, my wife and I would throw the kids in the car.
We'd go to the harbor.
And we'd go down and they'd get ice cream and we'd walk around and they'd buy something. And the place was alive. It was hot. But now we're in a different place. So let's not accept this for what it is.
Let's reimagine it.
Let's reimagine it.
Well, you know, I interviewed the head of Exelon, Calvin Burnett, and Brian Sepp, who... Sepniak? I never pronounce his name right. But anyways, the head of Care First. So the GBC, the Greater Baltimore Committee, and the Economic Alliance of Baltimore are merging into one organization. And I interviewed them over this because I have a huge interest in urban development.
Which I think is a good merge,
I agree.
By the way.
And I said
it's
to
cool.
them...
It's cool. When you travel, you see well-done things in other places
well, you
and
also,
say,
right.
bring
well, you
it here.
Also see, you know, you also, if you see cranes, that is a sign of something is happening. And the harbor needs, I'm not saying it needs cranes, but it needs some visible evidence that something is happening. I do think that there was just some, UMBC is somehow involved in creating some kind of task force panel to consider what to do with the Inner Harbor, but I haven't heard anything more about it.
I'll check. We'll check with that.
Well, it'll be a hell of a project for any of the universities around here to take
sure.
all the
load. And architects.
We'll suggest as Freeman walks away, let's just think big.
Put Freeman
let's
on
put
it.
Let's put Freeman, make Freeman the czar of reimagining Harbor Place.
Correct.
And put him, and something would happen, and people would have a sense.
I see a glass bridge,
energy.
But that's just me. You know?
Well, you have a lot of people that are living downtown. The problem is they don't have the amenities that you have if you're living in Canton in the 3500 block of Boston Street around Canton Crossing, where you got everything around you. You know, it makes it really easy. But the other thing I talked with about to these Calvin Butler with the head of
Calvin,
is that during the William Donald Schaefer years. There was this kind of core in Baltimore that involved not just city government, because that's just a piece, you know, but there was a really strong corporate core and a
banks.
Civic core, and even the nonprofit core.
Well,
and that's gone.
Yeah, the Walter Sondheims you had to buy.
Absolutely.
You had these corporate movers
and shakers. Hank Greenberg, Henry Rosenberg.
People that have been visionaries in their own space.
Well, they're invested. They were invested in the city. They had their offices in the city. You know, they had business in the city. And that is really gone. You don't have that core strength that we had. So when you ask me where I am, I'm thinking about this kind of large hole that somehow has to get filled, and who's going to step into it?
Leadership,
right. Leadership, it's not just a city hall leadership issue. This is a leadership issue with what do you want this city and region to be?
Well, who does the mayor turn to? So, you know, I mean, I talked about mayor. We've talked to mayor candidates we talked to you. That's a tough gig.
It is.
I mean, you start talking about where the leadership is.
Well, and there's no question that you have to get public safety under control in order for the rest of it.
That's the gospel according to Bowler.
Because
no, he's right. He's absolutely right.
Because nothing else, Jane, can happen.
Right.
But I've spoken with every gubernatorial candidate about this, and I've written about it. Democrats particularly have to understand that you can do two things at one time. You can believe that our streets should be safe.
Correct.
And good guys and bad guys shouldn't be running amok.
Correct.
And you can also believe that police shouldn't be abusing the hell out of people.
And you can get
both,
a water bill.
Absolutely.
And you should get a water bill.
And you can get a water bill that's
right.
accurate.
There you go.
All of those things can happen.
Basic
trash
stuff.
Picked up.
Yes, correct. Basic services.
And it seems to me, when you think about it, Jane, it's hard to imagine, but in the next census, Anne Arundel County.
It already is bigger.
Did it get bigger?
Yes.
Okay, I was going to say.
Baltimore City is now the fourth largest.
Okay, so now Anne Arundel.
Yes.
So it's remarkable, and the people who care about the city really are going to have to step up and make. I mean, what's your thought? I mean, I want to drift back before we run totally out of time because I want to talk about your career and the evolution of the I-Team and the difference that's made. But what's your thought on crime? What's not happening?
Oh, geez.
Because you've lived it, you've breathed it, you've been there.
Have you ever seen it done well in 40 years? I mean, has there ever been a point where you thought this?
We've never done anything different. So that answers the question.
I mean, you've been very critical of the overtime issue.
Yeah, well, that question answers itself. I mean, we've done the same thing all the time that I've been in Baltimore, we've done the same thing, and that is that we have relied almost exclusively on policing to get us public safety. And over time, you realize that's not happening. That's not you can't do that.
You need to make better people, not better cops.
Yes, and you have to deal with the behavior that is driving gun violence.
Right.
And that's not a policing matter by itself. I don't know. I think everybody's looking for what is a best practice. I think you can reduce Baltimore's crime rate by 10 or 15% by doing a few things. But I think until we have for example, I think if we did universal pre-K in school and robust during school and after school programming, I think you would start to see a difference in the involvement of youth in crime and in bad behavior. It takes a long time, and you have to stick with it. That's what we've never done. We have never had the patience to stick with something to see. You know, look what, in the late 90s, they were trying this idea of more intense probation supervision. This guy, David Kennedy, came from Harvard. They had this whole call-in thing. And then, we changed mayors and... out the window that went, and now we started to lock up everybody.
Well, Nestor's been, I think Nestor has been spot on about one thing, and that is, and we've talked to Matt Gallagher and police commissioners and people from the John Jay Institute about this, but the total failure of the criminal justice system and the way what we do with incarcerated people in terms of getting them ready to re-enter.
Yeah, we don't.
None.
Right, we don't.
We can talk to Uncle Larry about that, and it's this.
Yes, yeah.
And that's a failure of government. And
that has not been helpful in the last 7 years.
No, it was the only time when we chatted with the governor, and again, Nestor and I had a different take. The governor and I got along fine.
The governor was chippy with him.
He pushed.
I recognize.
He thought he was chippy. I thought we got along just fine, but he did not like when I pushed him on parole and probation because that's a state function.
And he's exactly right. And he has definitely what I hear from the inside.
Right.
So when O'Malley was governor, he had this effort called VPI, Violence Prevention Initiative, and I remember it well. I did stories when they had an offender that was under that supervision that did something, they were all freaked out, right? And my understanding from the inside is that it's not necessarily it ended, but it didn't have the staffing and support that it had previously. Now, there's also no question that the pandemic has had an awful effect on all of this because there's not been as much face-to-face, et cetera, et cetera. But, look, I'm on the board of Goodwill. I know that you're having Goodwill sponsoring.
Yeah.
And I've been on the board for 20 years. And two words that we talk about all the time in workforce development. And that organization deals with people who are returning offenders.
I talk to Lisa about it all the time.
Yep, right. So two words that we talk about, case management. Case management is, do you have a case manager to support all of the to support you in all of the hurdles you are going to have to clear in order to get on the better track. And I mean, it's a lot. So we don't make any effort to make sure they get driver's licenses, right, apparently. No. Dan Roderick strikes about this a lot.
Dan, you know? We've talked to Dan. There's no career training. I mean, it's really outrageous.
And it's a captive audience.
And there
it's a disservice to every citizen who is put at risk.
Right.
My wife walking down the street.
Right.
When there's someone on the street that should not be there, and there are people in the jail that know they shouldn't be there.
Right.
People in the system that look the other way, and then bang, we've got a problem.
Right.
And we say, oh, well, what happened? Well,
right.
Was there anything done to help this person before we put them on the street?
Right.
Yeah, it's one of the real, real gaps. Listen, before we let you run, we've talked pandemic a couple of times, and I know you've been open about it on the air. You and I text back and forth, checking in. You not only had a bout with COVID over a year ago, right?
Well, 13 months.
13 months ago. I thought it was just about a year. And you have not been immune to a long COVID, the symptoms.
I haven't
Tell
had
folks
one
a little
day.
Bit about what
I have
you've...
not had one day since February 12th. Actually, I didn't really start feeling bad with COVID until about February 15th. I tested positive on February 12th, 2021. I haven't had one day where I've thought, I'm over it.
What does it feel like? How do you describe it, Jane?
It's fatigue. My biggest complaint is fatigue, as is the case of most folks that still have longer running COVID symptoms, is fatigue. And it's like a breathing, I want to call it somewhere between shortness of breath and just a... It's just a discomfort about breathing. I didn't have respiratory
Do you feel
issues.
It on the golf course?
No. And so there's a lot of...
So the answer is play more golf, Jane.
The answer... Some of this has to
Right.
Some of this has to do with stress.
Correct.
And cognitive exertion. I mean, I've learned a lot, and I've been at the Hopkins Long COVID Clinic, et cetera, et cetera. The issue here, though, is there are a lot of people.
Are they studying you? Like,
yes,
you said,
I'm part of a study.
Okay, that's
right.
Interesting. Okay.
I just read a piece today in USA Today about, the millions of people that are estimated to be completely out of the workforce, never hospitalized, because they are stuck with these. The main symptoms are exactly that, is fatigue, this kind of, shortness of breath, whatever you want to call it. I test on everything just fine.
Well, see, that's what I read, Jane.
You can't figure it out.
Is the frustration of folks whose employers and insurance companies are going,
get over it.
Yeah, come on now. I guess...
It's a huge problem. It is a huge problem. It's amazing, too, that after 2 years, we don't have more understanding. There's some more understanding of what may be going on here. I think that what caught medicine by surprise, or at least they didn't anticipate, was that it seems to have
a... Now, wait a minute. I don't want to say that you attract a crowd. Come here, mister. We got the one and only Rob Roblin.
No.
We've got the Baltimore County executive.
No. Well, you can run here for lunch?
I just want to say hello to Pete. Pete, how you doing, Pete? Good to see you.
I mean, this is it.
Look
come
at
on
this. This isn't an Irish place. What are you doing up in here? Mike Moeller here. Wow, you got a whole... No, we're in the middle of the podcast here. What are we doing here?
Uh-oh.
All right. Now, listen.
No, okay.
You're sitting with the toughest journalist in town.
Now I have to, do work.
Why do you think I said no? I'm good. I'm just saying hi.
You got to get onto the camera, How are you?
Are you here for lunch?
This isn't Costas.
We're
is
actually
next
Friday. We're doing a tour and just saying hi to a few restaurateurs in the community.
Are you really?
Can I get your Betty Boop ticket?
The county executive's brother, who's our outstanding liquor commissioner, alcohol commissioner, lead. So we're just sort of...
Well, you're in a good place
rounds.
For alcohol. I'm getting margarita here later. Good choice.
It may have been the county executive brother who suggested.
Any tough questions? Get him in right now.
Really? Can I ask him a question? We're going to ask a question. Okay. Because we were just talking about...
Where's his hand? Where's your PR? Where's your molar? Pete's in charge of you today. Heating green room.
We were just talking about this. Just your own thoughts. We were talking about Baltimore's Inner Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And your thoughts on what... there's
a
lot
this.
Of discussion
like
going on about what should it be.
Uh-huh.
H&M,
if the Inner Harbor were in Towson.
Right.
If the Inner Harbor were in Towson, we would engage in a robust community engagement process where we brought some of the best and brightest minds to the table to say, here's what's possible, and then let's talk to community, business, anchor institutions to try to realize what that vision should be. So, I was going to preface it by saying,
I know.
I'm responsible for Baltimore County. I live
and
breathe it every day.
I got you. Right.
I believe in regionalism.
But the two of us aren't going to let you get away with that.
But I think it's what's that process works for us. It's how we've transformed our budget process. It's how we do the school process. It's like process matters. And when you involve people and you're transparent about what's possible and what's not, I think the results are better. So I don't mean to give you a
non-answer. That's not a non-answer. The other thing I'm going to ask, because you mentioned it, which is his role in Baltimore County Executive, you mentioned the regionalism. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I know you really promote. What do you mean by that?
I mean that we need to recognize that we are interrelated. It's everything we do, whether it's public safety, transportation, economic development, what happens in Baltimore matters to Baltimore County residents. And so it's both ensuring that our folks, our 850,000 people understand that, and then partnering with the mayor and city government in all the ways that we can to do things about those issues. And I think that, unfortunately, that we've sort of had waves of like regionalism matters and partnership. I think we're moving back in that direction where people understand that, and that we can't turn our backs to the city, and that we are in this together. So, since Mayor Scott came in, we've tried to really think about ways to partner big and small, whether it's we now have snow plows that like don't stop at the lines anymore.
That's
right?
A big deal.
I mean, like, no, like,
sounds would, like a little thing.
It's the not end and turn around. It's
listen,
like, no,
Officer
Adam,
right in front of the Eastwood Inn, it would just stop right across from Blackwell.
Well,
done.
And as we sort of see concerns about public safety, we've got Chief Hyatt, who spent a career in Baltimore City. She's now meeting regularly with Commissioner Harrison.
Correct.
Like, okay, how do we think about interjurisdiction?
Yeah, because they're happening on the same corridors that go. And they're not.
And there's not a politician I talk to who doesn't speak like this, whether it's Howard County, Harford County, Baltimore County, Anne Arundel County. Everybody's aware that, what the city represents and what Baltimore represents. We're all in it together.
Yeah.
Right.
And you're even here in Catonsville.
Right.
I love the Ville. It's my, adopted second
there
home.
There you go. All right.
All right. I'm going to let you guys get back to it.
There you go.
It.
I'm sorry. So, hijacked.
Before Jane has, a breaking news with a really thoughtful
question. No, I like to have conversations like this.
How about the former county executive take over for you? Is that all right?
Yeah.
While we're in Baltimore County.
No,
good seeing you, Johnny.
Thank you for all that you do to really highlight.
Big award last night. Congratulations.
I know. It's all
right.
Big award.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
But, I mean, this region's lucky to have you. The city's lucky to have you. Just thank you for, bringing to light really important stories.
Well, that's really as I've gotten older, one of the things that I've really kind of transitioned to is really trying to shed light.
Yep.
And to bring light to, let's think about this.
Mm-hmm.
What needs to happen to improve this? So, we all know we can do stories on what's wrong.
Yeah.
But let's try to find stories on what's right.
Right.
Baltimore positive!
Well, here you go.
There you go.
Okay.
So before I turn over the headset to the
couldn't get him
executive.
To sit down there. I can't get him to get up.
No, see, what I realize though is that I don't usually get to turn the table, so I get to ask Jane a question.
Okay.
Oh,
all right.
Good. All right.
Okay.
I thought it was
you've been
good.
Covering the region and the city
and
elected officials for a very long time.
Right.
What are things that I and my peers need to be really hyper focused on in the next year or two?
I'll tell you something, John. I think that that until we can calm down the toxic attitude towards Baltimore City, it's going to be very difficult to make any progress.
Mm-hmm.
I was on a Zoom call meeting last week, and it was 15 women, probably in their 60s, 70s. And they were trying to come up with a location for a meeting, and they were like, well, nobody wants to go downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And, this has to stop in order for there to be progress. The pandemic is winding down. We have got to, I tell people at community meetings, look, if you're with somebody at a cocktail party and they start bashing the city of Baltimore, just stop them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I mean, we have to figure out a way to create a more accepting attitude about Baltimore City. And I know I'm not going to turn this political. I mean, the governor in Annapolis has not been very helpful in this regard because he's been pretty harsh in describing Baltimore City and leadership, et cetera, et cetera. So that's, that's like, what's the magic bullet to that?
Yeah.
That's the question.
I do think we have an obligation to take actions, though, so that people can say, don't give up or believe in. So, because I think,
No, right. I agree. No,
yeah.
I agree
I think
with
it's
you
on
there.
Us individually to say, no, like, let's not just pile on Baltimore, but also that we need to have signs of, it is on us to say, we're doing, we're ramping up our community policing.
Right.
We're doing more upstream investments. We're being more proactive in engaging folks who are kids who are on the corners.
The water billing issue, which affects
you name it, right? Yeah.
No, so. I mean, and you guys just did a pretty large report on that.
Yeah.
So, I think you're right. You want tangible results to see. I mean, you mentioned this about public safety patrols mm-hmm. and the interrelationship between the city and the county, especially in those areas where they share the border. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, we mm-hmm. think we have this hard line, you know, oh, that's the county, it's the city. You know, to try to, you know, to do some things that may be visible in mm-hmm. that regard mm-hmm. that might be helpful. It's a real challenge. I know that. And you're not one. I know this. You're not a county executive that's like said, oh, forget the city.
Yeah.
Not at all. You know?
Well, I think that'd only be piling on, right?
Right.
And I think this is a moment where we need, to your point, just the opposite of that.
Yeah.
So.
Dude, I moved to the county a couple weeks ago. People are crushing me. And I'm like, you'll see pictures of me in the city 3 days a week. Right. I mean, right. I'm not leaving. And I didn't leave for that reason. But, you know, there really is like an... We talk to people in Tampa. They say they don't cross the bridge. There's a bridge there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know what that bridge is here, but I think I want to drop the mic on you saying that. That was like, yeah. I'm gonna cut that up. That's we got to stop at cocktail parties allowing people to say, I won't go there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right.
Well, that's beautiful.
Right.
Thank you again. Congratulations on the lifetime
you
achievement.
Good to see
and,
right.
You know,
right.
Former positive, always bringing in all the big hitters. Look at you guys.
Look at you, man. Well, Rob Roblin's, you know, batting cleanup around here. We know that. Don, are you done with Jane?
I've got
this?
One last question.
Okay, all right. One last question.
I do have to say to the executive, I think that we have to continue this. Do you think I have to get the other Mr. Mower and get a little golf foursome down at Rowing Road? What do you think?
I'd do that.
You know, I've got to warn you. Jane will hit it way past all of us.
And that's. I will definitely do that.
All right. Are you done with Jane?
I have one question.
Oh, okay.
One quick question before we get to the one and only Ryan.
I only have one question, too. But mine was, have you ever seen The Wire? But I'll
Jane,
say that.
Jane, a long career, many great stories. When you write your book and this memoir that will be a bestseller, the chapter on the story that touched you the most, that engulfed you the most, that really became compelling to you. What's that story?
There's actually two.
Okay, what are they?
Okay, so that one happened. They happened around the same time. This was a long time ago, in the 1980s. One was the death of a 9-year-old girl in the industrial area of Baltimore City, Maisha Jenkins. She turned out to be a child abuse victim, severe child abuse victim, and we were able to reveal that she had been the subject of repeated complaints in school and in the hospital, et cetera, of severe abuse before her death. And the result of that was that there was a kind of an awakening of the inability in the child support system.
I recall that story
in the
now.
Child Protective Services system.
I recall that story as well.
Yeah, she was found down along the road in Anne Arundel County. Her parents blamed some intruder. It was a made-up story, whatever. But it really revealed the kind of flaw of the inability of the system to flag kids that were really at high risk. And I think that led to some things that, were an improvement in the system.
Everybody looked the other way in this
child. Yeah, well, they were doing it. They had a manual filing system, and they just didn't have a system in place to say, flag this kid. And then the second is the Kirk Bloodsworth case, because he's the guy that was convicted of the 1984 murder of a 9-year-old girl in Rosedale. And, served, he was the first person to serve time on death row who was exonerated by DNA. And I did a lot of work on that case because it had some real flaws in the investigation. And then the prosecution. The problem with that case is that the evidence was really thin, but the crime was so heinous. I mean, heinous. I haven't covered anything like it since. And she was sexually abused. It was horrible. That no matter who you put in the chair, they were going to be convicted. That's what I thought about that case. And, so to make a long story short, Jim Smith was the judge, and the second time he was, prosecuted, saved the evidence in the case because he was...
I'll tell you the story when you're done.
Okay. And then DNA testing came along in the early 90s, and Kirk was begging to have DNA testing done. So it happened, and I think one of the reasons that Sandy O'Connor, the state's attorney in Baltimore County at the time, was like, sure, go test the evidence, because she thought they had a problem with the evidence in that case, and it was inadvertently destroyed that would have done, at least at that time, blood testing. It was body fluid, and they lost it. So I think she was like, oh, go ahead and test it because there's nothing to test. Well, DNA testing is able to capture smaller amounts of things, so that's what happened. And then the FBI confirmed it, and he was released from prison in 1993. And I say the reason that's significant to me is because he is the main reason the death penalty in Maryland no longer exists. He's a huge advocate against the death penalty, and he was used as the example because, I mean, he would be dead. I don't think there's any question about that. But for,
Don and I don't argue about much. We argue about baseball and the death penalty.
Yeah.
And I'd love to talk the other side of that.
Yeah, I'm as Nestor knows, I'm opposed to it. The Jim Smith story there, and he's told it to us on the air, but I remember one day, I guess Bloodworth's book came out, or there was a book came out,
there,
and
there was
a
book that came
on
Bloodworth. Right, yeah.
And I said to Jim, I said, walk me through that moment. And he goes, Don, to this day, I can't tell you why I did what I did. And I said, well, he said, well, I'm in my office.
Right.
I'd presided over the trial. Clerk comes in and says, Judge, what do you want us to do
with this box?
With this box of evidence. And Smith goes, what do you normally do? He said, I didn't really know what they normally did. He said, what would you normally do? He said, well, we would normally toss it.
Right.
And Jim said, I can't to this day tell you what it was. But I said, do me a favor, just put it in my closet.
That's where it was.
And it sat in his closet.
And well, then, you know, the next thing that happened in this case, this is the other reason that it's such a significant case, it comes full circle. So 10 years go by. He's released in 1993. It takes a long time for him to get his feet in the ground, obviously. And there was a DNA technician in Baltimore County. Case is still open now because he's been nullprossed. His charges have been nullprossed, okay? So now the case is open. And there's a DNA technician in Baltimore County that's like, it's sitting on the shelf was the sheet that was used to carry her body out of the woods.
Wow.
We have a video of that. They used the sheet to, you know, they had a body in a bag and they, you know, held the sheet. And
the things you've seen, Jane Miller.
Oh, my Lord.
I know, right. And so she says, you know what? Let's test that. Well, now they get an absolute hit through CODIS. The database.
Right, the database.
By that time, starting in the 1990s, they were collecting DNA of, you know, felony offenders that where it would be appropriate, you know, so rapists, et cetera, violent criminal.
And you said this was the worst crime you've...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, so what happened was the body fluid was all over that sheet. So now they had enough material not just to do an exclusionary test, but to do a fingerprint test. And they got a hit on a guy that had been serving time for rape in prison. Bloodsworth actually knew of him in prison. They were in the same prison together. And his story was that he lived on the bus line between, this was over in Fontana Village in Rosedale.
Mm-hmm.
He lived in Southeast Baltimore, but he was on that bus line. 2 weeks before the little girl was killed in Rosedale, he was released from jail because he had been acquitted in the sexual assault of a 12-year-old girl.
Mm.
One of the things that the psychiatrist in that case always told me about Bloodsworth is that he has no background in such an awful sex crime, right? And so this guy, whose name was Kimberly Shea Ruffner, had just been released, and crime happens 2 weeks later. And then a couple of weeks after that, he raped a woman in Fells Point who was able to identify him. And that's how he was convicted and in prison, and then ultimately had to, his DNA was put in the CODIS database. And then he pleaded guilty to the killing of the little girl.
I will read the book. I will focus on that
chapter.
I know,
man. I'm telling you. And Kirk tells his story. He tells his story of he got a call from Ann Probst, was the prosecutor at the time. And, because she has died. I'm trying to think. Anyway, the prosecutors at the time in Baltimore County called him in 2003 or 4, whatever year this was, and said they wanted to come, they wanted to meet with him. Well, he was living in Cambridge on the Eastern Shore. He made them meet him at the Burger King because he was not...
He wasn't
anyone. I'm coming to my house.
He wasn't
again.
Quite ready, right?
Right, and he always thought either coming back for
That's
me to
great.
Arrest me again, or to tell me they arrested someone else.
That's great.
Yeah, and so they
wow.
came down and told him, and
the stories you tell, congratulations.
Wait, can I tell one more story about that? And we should probably have Kirk on one day. So I'm going to tell you the moment in my career that I will never forget is Kirk was in prison in Jessup, and we had done a very lengthy story on the case, and we had done some follow-ups, and it was now 1992 when the public defender was representing him in Maryland, got the evidence from Jim Smith to test. And Sandy O'Connor wrote a letter and said, we're turning over the evidence for testing. If it comes back and it's not him, we'll release him. Well, again, the only reason she wrote that letter was because there's nothing there to test. We know that there's no test.
Except for the stuff in Jim's
She doesn't know what's in there, right. No, she doesn't know what's
on the story.
Right.
Really?
Well, it was it's the semen that was what was lost. Okay, they had semen samples, and they lost them in 1984. What she didn't know is that some of that was on the girl's underwear, which was in that box.
In the closet.
In the closet, correct. So they send it to California. This guy, Ed Blake, was the one who had been doing DNA testing in the United States. Because remember, Great Britain was ahead of the United States on DNA testing. So I said to Kirk in a conversation, I said, you know, this is like truth or dare time. Because it's possible with the testing that they were doing that he could still be included in the group, in the possible group. Okay, they were doing an exclusionary test. They weren't doing a fingerprint test. In other words, they didn't have enough material to say, this is who this belongs to. They had enough material to say, it doesn't belong to you.
X, right.
Right. But it could be, you could be in the group of those it does belong to. Okay? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And I said to him, so you know, this is like a real shot here because of the kind of testing that was being done, that you could still be under suspicion here, you know? He said to me, Miss Miller, I didn't do this. Just like that. So, months go by. And I get this call, and I'm going to choke up when I say this, okay? I'm warning you, okay? I get this call, collect call from Jessup, and it's Kirk. And on the other, when I accepted the call, he couldn't even speak. He was sobbing, and he said, it's not me. See how it's your comment?
I don't blame you.
I mean, think about it. This is a guy who was on death row.
Right.
Okay? Now he was sentenced in the second, because he was prosecuted twice. Second time he was sentenced to consecutive life terms, whatever. And now you have in front of you proof of what you've been saying. I didn't do this, you know? And, I mean, just it was powerful. And he was released a month later.
3 decades later. This is...
Yeah,
that's a pretty good story,
he's,
Jane.
He's I just did a story with him because he's been out now for 20, 30, whatever it is, however many years it is. And he's done a lot of work around the country, and he's really known. You know, the Mid-Atlantic Innocence folks who he works for, they said there's really no case like his because it has such definition to it.
Amazing.
Some
not many judges kept a box. In
no, it, right. Exactly. It just based has all gut, of these pieces
on a gut
to
feeling,
it.
Right?
Based on nothing,
right? I talked to Jim about it. Yeah. I know.
Well, did Johnny O just come in and sit down and have This Is Your Life with Jane? Did that really happen in this segment?
I'm telling you, Jane Miller.
It's like Wayne's World.
Lifetime Achievement Award, First Amendment. The I team. What else can we say? We knew this would be a good one.
All right. Don Moeller, Baltimore County Executive. We're here. Rob Roblin's going to be next. After that, I mean, I wish we could bring back all the old-timers here.
We can.
Where's Rudy Miller? I want Rudy on the show.
That's a good question.
I still have a crush on Rudy. She knows that. Jane Miller, for being our guest, will receive either the pink or the blue Betty Boop tickets, all courtesy of the Maryland Lottery. And I really appreciate the shout-out on Goodwill because I had this conversation like last week about Goodwill, and I'm like, Jane does their summer event every single year.
No, I've been on the board there a long time.
I've been at those events in the audience, so our big appreciation to Goodwill
thank
as well.
Thank you both, too, for
thanks,
what you
Jane.
Do.
Thank you. We're okay. El Guapo. We had a great couple segments. We got more. Alan McCallum's going to talk some baseball later. We're going to talk to Evan. We're going to have a crab cake. We didn't even get you a crab cake.
We'll get a crab cake.
Back for more in Catonsville. We are Baltimore Positive with WNST AM 1570.